Animal stories are found in every culture, every place in the world, every time in history. An effort to sort of discover what we're like and to pass on information to children. Generations have always thought it works to try and draw pictures of animals to help us make discoveries we don't want to make about ourselves. We don't want to see so clearly in ourselves. Aesop's fables, Grimm's fairy tales, Uncle Remus's yarns, Dr. Seuss stories in the more modern era, even superhero legends of today, Batman and Spider-Man and Wolverine and Catwoman. There's all kind of the combining of the characteristics of animals and human personalities and trying to discover stuff about ourselves that is hidden often. And usually with some humor, usually a sense of kind of seeing ourselves, able to laugh at ourselves perhaps more easily. When Adam and Eve disobeyed God in the very beginning, their first action, their first immediate action was to cover themselves up. They covered themselves with clothing. They covered themselves with lies. They distanced themselves first from God, then from each other, and they finally even distanced themselves from themselves. I cannot see myself anymore. I'm hiding from myself is one of the consequences of the fall. And in the gospel, we hear the great declaration. Whenever anyone turns to the Lord, the veil, the mask, is taken away. The Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. So animal stories have the quality sometimes of helping us to discover what is we're masking from ourselves, perhaps to see ourselves in a way that will allow us to turn to the Lord and cry out for help and want the freedom that comes with honesty. There are three stories or accounts, analogies, I guess, is the best term, in the Proverbs that we're going to look at today. This is the eighth and final message in a series on the Proverbs. We've been looking at themes and discovering life lessons and the challenges of wisdom and hope that comes as God in, both speaks to us and strengthens us. And this is the final one, and it's kind of, as you've already recognized now, we'll have the theme of analogy to the animal kingdom as its thread. So there are three, as I said, passages we're going to look at. The first is a lion and his friends. And what we might learn, the rooster, Foghorn Leghorn in the cartoon might come to mind when we read the first of these stories. The second is about an ant, the story of the paying attention to an ant and what we can learn from that. And the last one is a leech. It's a darker story, darker comment in which a leech serves as an example of a kind of human behavior. So would you turn to chapter 30, verse 29, and we'll read a section that begins with a lion on the stage. There are three things that are stately in their stride, four that move with stately bearing. Stateliness is to stand upright, to move with confidence, to know where you're going and go there with deliberation and not be daunted by anything. And in the pattern of Proverbs 3, yea, 4, that's a common way of introducing some information, three things, and now I will add a fourth, and the list is before us. We'll get to it in a second. When those lists exist, it's the fourth thing that we're supposed to pay most attention to, the last one on the list. There are three things that are stately in their stride, four that move with stately bearing. A lion, mighty among the beasts, who retreats before nothing. A strutting rooster. A he-goat. And a king with his army around him. Now, I've mentioned more than once in the last few weeks that references to royalty are references to ordinary Christian life, in fact. That when we see a king acting either in history in the Old Testament or acting by analogy in a passage like this, we're supposed to learn lessons about what it means to follow Christ. Every follower of Jesus, everyone who knows God in Christ, is a son or daughter of a king, of the king. We are all royal figures. We are all intended to reign in life. We've commented on that more than once. And I think that's helpful to note again in this place. There's a king. That's the focus of this, the end of the story. But I think we're going to discover that this king is fooling himself. There's a facade that needs to be peeled away. There's a mask that needs dealing with. There's a false grandeur about this king that probably will be instructive to us. Kings are supposed to walk with their heads up. It's good and proper and right to stand tall if you are a son of the king and are yourselves a royal person. To be confident, to move forward in life knowing who you are, to be sure of your status and your name and your standing before the God of heaven, to approach life with a sense of direction and involvement, a chance to be a blessing and make a difference. That's the way kings are supposed to live. And we'll look at the animal kingdom perhaps and see, you know, that kind of bearing among the animals and what do we learn from them. Well, the lion is a good start. It's not afraid of anything. Goes wherever it wants. If you watch a lion walk, it has a stately stride. It's just a powerful, beautiful animal. Everything about it is kind of regal and royal in its aspect. And so that's good. If I'm supposed to have a life of a head held high, not afraid, not bowed down with burdens, not overwhelmed by life, not stumbling and failure, a lion is a good image for a king. But the next two, I think, are intended to be the odd pair. The wait a minute, let's look at this carefully. Let's ask some hard questions and so on. The rooster and the billy goat raise some other questions. What? A lion is a carnivore, not afraid of anything, goes wherever it wants. A rooster struts, of course. If you've ever seen a rooster walk, it has this stiff gait and its head bobs and it's kind of looks like it's strutting. But it's a domesticated animal, isn't it? It's only safe when it's protected by a farmer or animal keeper of some kind. When it's in its pen, it struts only in relationship to other hens and chickens. And it's not intrinsically authoritative or powerful or dangerous or regal. Same thing with a billy goat. This is a domesticated animal in this case. And it is likely to be a victim of some wild beast, some stronger party, unless it's protected and cared for. A goat has kind of a funny stride, too, determined and sure-footed, but it has a strutting aspect to it as well. But it's only in the right circumstances, only under positive conditions, only when protected by someone else. And the king, as he's described here, has a modifier. A king is stately when he's surrounded with his army. And I think that's giving us a suggestion of some lessons we can learn about what makes us, how do we reign in life, in fact? What gives us real authority and a real sense of purpose and confidence? Where does it come from? This king is only king when he's surrounded by his army, and is perhaps more like a rooster and a goat than he wants to admit. I mentioned that the middle pair of animals here are domesticated rather than free and wild and substantial on their own. The other thing I think to observe about a rooster and a goat is that they're funny looking. And I'm guessing that wherever you are in the world, however you have sort of interacted with the created world, you're going to think roosters are funny looking. They just are. They've got these wattles that, bounce around, and they kind of look peculiar, and they move peculiarly, and they act as if, you know, they're a bigger deal than they are, and they're funny looking. Goats are funny looking. There's nothing cool about being a goat. It just... I mean, the guy that's screwed up in the game is the goat, right? It's just natural to laugh at them or something. You know, kings, think about the banners of the great military machines of history. Rome marched under the great standard of the eagle. The Roman eagle was the terror of the world in its day, as its legionaries would pour across countries and these flying golden eagles before them. And, you know, eagles are cool and tough and free and powerful. And, you know, kings put lions on their shields and they make songs about wolves and stallions and cool ants. There's never, you know, King Richard the Rooster-hearted, or, you know, you never run into one of those. And this king is, in the story, is being compared to animals that don't have quite the internal authority that the lion has. And I think that's really the question that's being asked here. What makes us stand tall? What gives us the right to hold our head up? What allows us, under whatever circumstances exist, to lean forward instead of cringing back, to bear the weight instead of stumble under it? I want to take you to a point in time in the Old Testament, one of the great scenes in the Bible, and make some observations about kings. It's the Valley of Elah. And there's an army of Philistines on one side of the valley and an army of the children of Israel on the other. Saul is their king. This is one of the unique points, probably the unique point in Israel's history, when there were two kings who had the right, had been anointed by Samuel, who had been called by God to be king. Saul first, and then he failed and the Lord turned from him and had Samuel anoint a second king, the young man David. Both guys are on the scene. Saul, when you're introduced to him in the Bible, he stands a head taller than everyone else. He is impressive to look at. We can imagine him with a deep voice, filled with command in his voice, long flowing hair. His stature was impressive. He looked good on the outside. And he's standing in front of his army in the Valley of Elah. And every day there came a giant to the low point of the valley and looked up at the armies of Israel. And he taunted them. He taunted Saul by name. He taunted the God of Israel. He ridiculed them day after day for weeks, and they couldn't do anything about it. And here was a king with his army, but a king who couldn't lead his army, a king who couldn't answer the opposition, a king who didn't know what to do, a king who couldn't act, a king who was frozen. However he looked, and whatever he was surrounded by, he was not a king who was able to function as Israel's king. And there's this other guy, a young man who was too young to be impressive in stature at all. It says of David, when you meet him, that he was ruddy of complexion, which probably means that he wasn't old enough to grow a beard. That when Samuel came to his family to anoint kings, all of his brothers passed before them. They didn't invite him to come in. He was beneath consideration. God had to finally tell Samuel that the Lord doesn't look on the stature, the outside, the exterior. The Lord looks on the heart. And finally, David is brought in and God said, this is the one. And he's a boy sent into the same arena and he's standing there. No armor will fit him that he can wear. He's too young to go into battle with anything, any ordinary armament. And he says, I will fight the giant. It's, again, the story of David and Goliath is known to people that don't know almost anything else about the Bible. And David, this young shepherd boy, takes his sling and a rock and fells the giant and defeats the enemy. And he says this, let all this assembly know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or by spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into my hand. David speaking to this 10-foot-tall, terrifying warrior of the Philistines. So what's the point? There's two kings. There's David with no army, David with no armor, David with no weapon, David with youthfulness, inexperience, and a heart for God. And there's Saul that has all the rest. He has the army, he has the armor, he has the weapons, he has the standing. He's been king before, he's led men in battle. There he stands and he's paralyzed. And the young man without anything defeats the giant. You become a king by who you are on the inside, I think is the point. It's not what surrounds you. It's not what other people say. It's not the folks who clap when you come into the room. It's not the degrees you can claim as accomplishments in life. It's those things don't make a king. Some people have observed, it's been observed of these two men at this point in their life, that Saul was only a king because he had an army around him. David would later lead an army because he was a king. Because he was a king, an army came to him and followed him and believed in him. Saul was only a king if he had the surrounding support and the external reinforcement that he was worth something. Think about the giants in your life for a minute. Think about the things that are so hard. The taunting voice that it may be a person, it may be a very hard relationship that someone is determined to make your life miserable. But I think for many other folks, it's not even quite, the giant doesn't even take the form of a particular person. It might be a vicious form of depression that returns again and again in your life and mocks you, saps your strength, takes away opportunity, blights your hope, and he taunts you and he taunts your God, and he won't stop. Could be a need for money that is so desperate you can't let loose of it, and your requirement to have more and more has ruined your life. It could be an addiction. It could be a fear of ridicule. It could be lust. It could be any of a number of things. Giants that stand in your way every day. And say, as the giant said to Saul, you say you're a king? You're nothing. I stand here and you have nothing to say. Nowhere to turn. No answer. You know what giants aren't impressed by? They aren't impressed by resumes. They aren't impressed with how many people think you're cool. They aren't impressed by all the folks you know and the names you can drop and the retinue that follows you around and looks up to you perhaps. They aren't impressed with people that clap when you walk into the room. Giants are impressed by the presence of God. And that's all David had with him as he walked into the valley and said, this giant will not demean the name of the Lord God of Israel. And I think the point being made is we're supposed to be stately in our stride. And we become that way when the Spirit of God strengthens us. We become that way when our weapon is the Word of God. We know the Scriptures, we believe them, we speak them, we advance in their truth. When we humble ourselves before God and trust Him no matter what we have to go into, we move forward not in our own confidence, but in the confidence that comes from character that's been formed by hope. We are changed people. We are changed from the inside. And the giant has no right to taunt us anymore. God defeats giants, not armies, not externally reinforced sense of who we are. David was a king from the inside out. David had an army, as I mentioned before, David had an army follow him because he was a king. Saul was a kind of king because an army seemed to indicate that he was. You remember the story of the Emperor's Clothes, Hans Christian Andersen, one of his most famous stories. It's a wisdom story. It's a proverbial sort of story, and it's these tricksters come to the small kingdom, and they claim to be tailors, and they're going to make this beautiful clothing for the king. And they talk about how beautiful it is, and they're so facile with language that they get everybody to believe that. And there's nothing there. There's nothing on the loom. There's no cloth. There's nothing. And yet they claim that it is, and so the king puts on his nothing clothing, and all the people around him say, "Oh, how beautiful you look!" And nobody's willing to admit, "I don't see anything." Do you see? No, nobody can say that because they'll feel themselves foolish. finally the king is parading down the street, and there's a little boy that speaks up. Well, I reread the story this week. I hadn't read it for a long time, and I forgot how it ended. Let me just read the ending. "But he has nothing on at all," said the child at last. "Good heavens, listen, the voice of an innocent child," said the father. And one whispered to another what the child had said. "But he has nothing on at all," cried at last the whole people. And that made a deep impression on the emperor. For it seemed to him that they were right. But he thought to himself, now this is the ending that I'd forgotten. "I must bear up to the end. The chamberlains walked with still greater dignity, as if they carried a train which did not exist." Even in the face of being unmasked, the only retreat I have is to play the game even more, is to pretend even harder that I'm not a fool, is to pull the mask even tighter on myself, that I am an emperor, even though it's not true, that I am a man of substance, even though it's not true, that I am well clad, even though it's not true. And I think the gospel, the word of the gospel, that when we turn to the Lord, the mask can come off, the veil can be removed, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom. And where there's freedom, there's stateliness and hope and confidence and purpose. The king is a king. The queen, the royal person, is a royal person because of who they are from the inside. Well, the second of these animal analogies that we'll read is in chapter 6, verse 6. This is also kind of introduced to us in our clip. It's the way ants are and the way sluggards are. I'm going to read another verse first, just quickly. We'll consider verse 6 at some length. But in 26:13, it says this, and the sluggard is actually the kind of fool that we're, the kind of mask, the kind of person who doesn't understand himself that needs to be set free that we're dealing with here. And in 26:13, it says this. The sluggard says there's a lion in the road, a fierce lion roaming in the streets. I love the word sluggard. I just think it's such a great word. It sounds like what it is. I mean, it's just this dull of hearing, slow-moving, self-involved, soft, disengaged person. And the sluggard comes in for a fair amount of advice in the book of Proverbs. But in 26:13, we hear him speak, and he says, "There's a lion in the streets, a fierce lion roaming in the streets." There's no lion in the streets. The attitude of this person is, there's always something dangerous outside the door. I better not take any risks at all. I better not open the door. I better not get out of bed. I better not try anything, because I know there's a lion out there somewhere. And something bad will happen. No matter what I do, something bad will happen. And I will be in danger, and I can't take any risks. Let me stop at this point and ask you to think of, is there some joy that you're missing out on? Some opportunity to serve God? Some beauty that you might be able to see and feel? Some relationship that might mean something? And you've just basically lived as if no risk is worth taking? Might be worth just asking, Lord, have I shut the door because I've imagined terrors that don't exist? More to the point, to turn to chapter 6, verse 6, we'll have our sluggard again with some instruction. "Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider its ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer or ruler, yet it stores its provisions in summer, gathers its food at harvest. How long will you lie there, you sluggard? When will you get up from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a bandit and scarcity like an armed man." Now, this story has a beginning and an end. The sluggard makes decisions about his life and reaps disaster. The bandit comes, the crisis comes, the unexpected terrible moment, the caving in comes, the disaster strikes. But for the sluggard, What will be the case is that crises repeat themselves. The choices that brought about the first disaster, the first theft, the first awful circumstance will happen over and over again if the person, the fool, doesn't change the way he thinks and acts. It's a little sleepiness, a little folding of the hands, kind of a one-time avoiding of responsibility, being late just every now and then, telling a few lies, small ones, white lies, pampering myself only in this case, but not so often, and it's only a small thing, and it doesn't seem to be that big a deal, and why should anyone care anyway? And the repeated self-indulgence, the repeated sleeping, folding of hands, pulling back, refusing responsibility. And then all of a sudden the disaster strikes and the house collapses and all of a sudden there's economic turmoil. All of a sudden my family's in a mess. And all of a sudden, the point is it's not all of a sudden, of course. There's just been this gradual poking of holes in the dam. Little leak, little leak, little leak, and eventually the dam gives way. And finally it's repaired, and the same process happens again. A little this, a little that, a little, and all of a sudden, disaster strikes. People that have repeated crises of the same kind over and over again are probably folks who need to go to the ants and learn the lesson that's taught here. So what does the ant teach? Two things, I think. The first is that you need to be able to learn to work without being monitored. You need to be able to learn responsibility that doesn't require somebody telling you what to do. Any of you who's tried to raise children, any parents will know that you spend your life trying to help your children do what they ought to do because they choose to do it rather than having you hector them or make promises, you know, carrots and sticks, bribing and, you know, from toilet training to graduate school, you know, the whole gamut. At some point, what you're trying to do is get them to make the right choice for the right reason, moved by some kind of internal sense of responsibility. Ants seem to get it. They're cruising around. One of them picks up this. One of them goes there. They don't have anybody in charge. No pressure from above. No threats. They make choices. Thoughtful, you know, right choices, helpful choices, without being anyone demanding that they do so. And that's a sign of maturity, surely. The second thing that the ant does is plan for the future. If today is a good day and opportunities exist and a chance to set aside provision and think ahead, then that's today's responsibility, to think ahead for tomorrow, to make provision, to store up for the time when the good times won't be here, to recognize that tomorrow may not be exactly like today. And so the one commentary I read even named these ants with their Latin name. It's a Messor semirufus ant, the harvester ant that's in view here. And that's their characteristic, be able to store food ahead of time. There's a word of Jesus that I want to read to you in this context before we move on to our third thing. Jesus said, "Come to me, all of you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Come to me, Jesus said. And what we find when we come to Jesus is a yoke, his yoke, him joining us and giving us opportunity, a chance to serve, a place of significance. But his yoke is easy. It's not hard. It's not something that's unbearable. We have valuable contributions to make. But we make them in concert with him. We make them in his power. We make them with his blessing. We live life with a sense of his intimacy with us and his holding us up along the way. And then he said, "I will give you rest. I'll give you engagement and I will give you quiet. I'll give you times when there's a freedom to relax in the deep comfort of God's gifts. Life worth living and rest as I give it to you. That's what Jesus said he offers when we come to him. Most people I know in this valley don't know anything about rest. They don't know how to live with a rhythm, myself included. I'm not sort of pointing fingers at anybody else, but it's so hard for us to find balance. And the striking thing about the lazy person, the sluggard, is that they never rest either. The people who are chronically self-indulgent never rest enough, never find themselves satisfied with their lives and able to turn loose of things. They are forever having to reinforce their indulgence, if you will. And Jesus promises a kind of balanced, healthy, beautiful way of life that he gives to those who come to him. I want to just read this last passage. I won't have time to talk about it much, but I think it's worth looking at the leech and what a leech is like. And this paragraph ends with a vulture, so we have both bloodsuckers and carrion eaters here. So it's a little darker version of things, but it's good to be reminded of, warned about. There are those who curse their fathers and do not bless their mothers, those who are pure in their own eyes yet not cleansed of their filth, those whose eyes are ever so haughty, whose glances are disdainful, whose teeth are swords and jaws are set with knives to devour the poor from the earth and the needy from mankind. The leech has two daughters, that is, two progeny. The leech produces two things, and it's just the cry, give more, give more. The leech has two daughters, give, give, they cry. There are three things that are never satisfied, that never say enough. The grave, the barren womb, land which is never satisfied with water, and fire which never says enough. The eye that mocks a father and scorns obedience to a mother will be pecked out by the ravens of the valley, will be eaten by the vultures. The simple perspective here is this. If we don't bow our knee in gratitude to our parents, the disobedience to parents both begin and end this section. You know, refusal of parents. What we'll be left with instead is ourselves as the maker of ourselves. That we are the folks who have formed ourselves. We've promoted ourselves. We've adorned ourselves. We've evaluated ourselves. We've glorified ourselves. There's no one before whom we acknowledge thanks. There is no God beyond our parents to whom we acknowledge thanks. We are the maker and designer and shaper of all that we are. And those who have never learned to be thankful to anyone, starting with their parents, who have never learned to bow the knee, who have never learned gratitude's lesson, will never be satisfied. There's never enough. More is always demanded. It being grateful for something allows us the freedom to not need everything in sight, to not grasp for more and more. There's an old children's song that I think is worth remembering. Count your many blessings, name them one by one. Count your many blessings, see what God has done. If we're thankful, then we're not so desperately grasping for one more thing, one extra advantage. Gratitude frees us to have enough and not need, everlastingly need more. It's not really helpful to be compared to a leech, but it's instructive. Maybe it's important. Maybe there's something to learn. More, more, more. The animal kingdom helps us sort of see the delusions that we carry around. Sometimes when it's given to us front on, we don't respond very well. But we look at Foghorn Leghorn make a fool of himself in a cartoon, or we look at some person who can't function very well and is caved in on themselves, indulging themselves as a lazy sluggard, and look at the ant. And slowly but surely we begin to see stuff in ourselves that we don't want to see, but we need to see, and so on. This is I think this kind of instruction helps us be honest in ways that are hard. But I want to return in closing now to 2 Corinthians 3:16, because it's not just enough to be honest. It's not just enough to say, I am not who I ought to be. There is a remedy that we must choose, and the remedy, just by way of simple reminder, is this. Whenever anyone turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away. Now, the Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. And we, who with unveiled faces all reflect the Lord's glory, are being transformed into His likeness with ever-increasing glory, which comes from the Lord, the Spirit. We turn to the Lord. The veil is removed. We see the face of Christ and are transformed by it and become more and more like Him. Free, stately, useful, with a sense of our own purpose and involvement, with thankfulness, free, like Christ, masks off. And that's what the gospel holds for us. And I want to end with that as a word of encouragement. Now, here's the final thing to do, and it's just each of us doing it by ourselves. In your bulletin is a card, a little postcard, 3x5 card, something like that. And in your bulletin, there's the list of the 8 sermons that have been given in this series. I think they're going to appear on the screen as well, references to them. And what I want to ask you to do is go back over what we've talked about in this series on Proverbs. Go back and remember, was there one point, one or two things, one word of encouragement, one word of challenge that comes out of these texts that we've studied together that you realize God spoke to you? I'm supposed to do something about that. I'm supposed to believe what I haven't believed. I'm supposed to act in ways I haven't. You're going to have a couple minutes now, just in quiet, by yourself, and write something on the card if you have something to write. If the Lord has spoken to you, put down what it is that he has witnessed to you about. And then I want to suggest you just stick it in your Bible in the Proverbs. Just leave it in there. And the next time you're reading through the Bible, or perhaps it'll flop open to that place because there's a card in there or something, by some means or other, it will be in your Bible. You'll take it with you. And the hope is, of course, that having identified what the Lord has said, that you will have the strength to respond to it as well. So would you take a few moments in quiet and consider all of the 8 weeks we've had and what the Lord might have said to you.